Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Should I give you that chronological thing and then you can cut down what you need?
Sure. You can summarize. But.
Yeah. My name is Ian Heath. I live in Redmond, Washington. So I spent about 28 years in the software business as a software engineer.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect from KNKX. And I'm in Ian Heath's workshop overlooking Lake Sammamish.
I spent some time at Visio, downtown Seattle. Had a couple of small, unsuccessful stints at Microsoft. My longest engagement was at Tableau Software in Fremont, where I was about 9 years. And as one of the earlier employees, I was very fortunate. They were paying me more in stock than in salary. So in 2013, we took the company public. At that point, I had the opportunity to not have to do a 9-to-5 job anymore. And it's funny, I remember talking to my manager at the time, who was also one of the earlier employees. I told him that I was going to leave. And I said to him, I wonder if there'll be an exodus. Do you think you'll leave? And he said, I don't know. I don't know what I would do with myself. And I realized that a lot of people, their job defines who they are. And for me, as a sort of a creativity junkie with loads of hobbies, I knew there was stuff I had to do. I had a list of things I wanted to do, and I didn't need a 9-to-5 job to keep me occupied. I knew I would find ways to amuse myself.
Like small round flat bricks and 1x2 bricks and some specialized bricks.
I decided to focus on becoming a Lego artist. Everything is awesome. My specialty is building characters out of Lego. A lot of Lego artists focus on vehicles and landscapes and buildings because Lego is a kind of rectilinear medium. I decided that...
Wait a minute, it's a kind of what?
A rectilinear medium. It's very blocky, so people tend to build buildings. So I decided to focus on building characters and organic things and creatures, which seemed like a much more interesting challenge. I'd had some success. My first custom model was a little model of Stephen Hawking, which surprisingly went viral and is still very much, it's being discovered to this day by people for the first time.
So, okay, this is the famous Stephen Hawking model right there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's Stephen Hawking sitting in his specialized wheelchair with his speech device and so on. So there's a few details of this. Can I touch it?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I found interesting and compelling about this is the posture of mm-hmm. things like the legs. Stephen Hawking, if you look at a picture of him as he sits, his knees are a little bit off to the side and his legs are a little bit slanted. It's not all right angles like you typically might get with mm-hmm. with Lego. And so how did you do that?
It's just like a form of sculpture. And I tried to get things as accurate to the reference material, the images I'm working from. Yeah, so with the Stephen Hawking model, you have this very rectangular chair, which is all right angles and very, very mechanical. But you have this frail, twisted person inside, and that really helps the viewer engage with it because it looks like lifelike. So for me, it's a very iterative process. The first pass I do of a model looks terrible, but it looks like it's been just cut out of stone, and then I just keep carving away edges and rebuilding parts of it to make it more faithfully represent the thing I'm trying to copy. I don't like to accumulate bricks indefinitely, so once I've shown a model at a couple of shows, I destroy it. I keep a few that are my favorites, but the rest ultimately get ground down and sorted back into the collection.
So now that you're a full-time and rather renowned Lego artist, can you imagine going back to work full-time in software?
I really cannot. I do miss the job sometimes, some aspects of it, and I certainly miss my Tableau family and the community I built there, and I was very proud of what I did. But I derive enormous satisfaction from my Lego projects. So I'm kind of a failed artist, something of a creativity junkie. So I've always had hobbies which involve making things. And I just, up here in my little nest, I can, see the world go by, and I just have music playing in the background, and I'm just in kind of my happy place, just producing art.
This week on Sound Effect, our theme is Off the Job. Stories of people making a break with their old gigs, and what comes after. That's ahead on today's show from KNKX. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Off the Job. Some people report to work purely for the paycheck. For others, it's more than a job. It's part of who they are. Gregory Blackstock is a man who knows both of those experiences. If you were to chart his career path, it would go something like this. Dishwasher, 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 internationally renowned artist. Gregory is famous for drawing collections of objects like trains, crows, airplanes. Even when he just writes a list of words, there's something about the way they end up on the page that makes you want to look at them. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing introduces us to Gregory and to the woman in his life who makes it possible for him to succeed in a world that, at first, neither of them knew anything about.
Before meeting 72-year-old Gregory Blackstock, I am prepared for this encounter by his cousin, Dorothy Frisch.
He's loud, he's big, he talks a lot. He wants an audience for the things that he talks about. So if you're in the room with him, he will corner you and talk for ever about what's interesting to him. There's no back and forth or give and take in a conversation. Hi, Greg.
I love.
How are you doing?
Let's see if these are the right cookies that you like.
Yep.
Oh, good.
Gregory Blackstock is autistic. His home is a small apartment in an assisted living facility in the Northgate neighborhood of Seattle. And on this day, what he wants to show us and talk about is a clip from the 1962 film It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And he's especially taken with the character Mrs. Marcus, who's played by Ethel Merman.
It's a mad world. How did Ethel Merman sound to you?
Loud.
In the country, drive on, you big stupid idiot.
Those are pretty harsh words, aren't they?
Yeah, but I like the movie so.
Gregory Blackstock, or Greg, as his cousin Dorothy calls him, has been labeled a genius and a savant. He speaks multiple languages he's learned over the years by listening to lessons on his record player. He plays the accordion, and he is a gifted artist whose drawings sell for thousands of dollars and are in collections all over the world. Greg adores Dorothy, and he knows that his current life would not be possible without her. Do you mind if I ask you what you love about your cousin Dorothy?
Mostly, getting me into world-famous artistry is the main thing.
That was a very, very important part of your life, too.
I needed that.
Why'd you need it?
I just want to get away from drudgery. I'm in a food and beverage business. I have to do drudgery all the time.
Before becoming a world-famous artist, Greg worked for decades as a dishwasher at the Washington Athletic Club in downtown Seattle. It was a place that treated him very well, but it was also a place he was happy to leave.
And now you can support yourself with your art. That's a pretty amazing thing after you retired from all that drudgery. That's very special, Greg. Not everybody gets to have a job that they love after a job that they didn't love.
Inside his apartment is a drafting table where he works. A bookcase is filled with volumes that have titles like Guide to Wildflowers of North America, Parrots of the World, Birds of Europe, and Dangerous Marine Mammals. He devours these books and catalogs what he learns onto paper. Dorothy unrolls one of the drawings Greg is working on.
Ooh,
what is it?
Ooh. Greg, can you read the title for her out loud?
Yeah, the Great World Moths.
The Imperial Moth and the White Witch Moth. Wow. His freehand images are neatly lined up on paper. They're often in color and outlined with black marker. They look like carved block prints. In this style, he has drawn bird wing butterflies, leghorn roosters, aphids, even outboard motor racing boats.
He has never drawn the third parrot from the left on his parrot drawing. That's the first time he's ever tried it.
and it's on the finished drawing. His drawing is very static on the page, but it's very lifelike to him. He recently did a drawing of grizzly bears in different colors. He will walk around the room and do a fierce grizzly bear growl that he picked up from a old Disney television show about wildlife.
I'm just getting up close to him here.
I want to stay pretty far from grizzly bears, that's for sure.
Today, Dorothy is Greg's official guardian, but it didn't start out this way. In the 1970s, when Dorothy was heading out into the world, excited to build an adult life, Greg's mother wanted to groom Dorothy to be Greg's caretaker.
I was kind of watching him from the sides all the time saying, he's not my problem, he's not my problem, he's not my problem. But of course, I inherited him because there was nobody else.
Greg's parents were dead. His only sibling, his brother, also died. Dorothy knew that if she didn't embrace this responsibility, which she had held at arm's length for so long, that her cousin would end up on the streets.
He could so easily be homeless, and he would look just like the kind of homeless people that we all walk by and say, oh, you know, somehow that must be his fault or her fault that they're homeless. But he would have just plain run out of money and not have had any way to generate any more income.
The first time Gregory showed that he had a knack for drawing was years ago in the early 1970s when his mom was still alive. He drew a collection of tools on paper and showed it to his mother.
And she said, oh, it's great, but it's too big. I don't know how big of an impact that had, but he waited another at least 10 years before he started doing anything else.
When he did pick up a pen again, nothing stopped him.
Something in his soul would wither if he did not have the ability to put on paper what he wants.
The Washington Athletic Club, where Gregory washed dishes, put his drawings in its newsletters. And then one day, Dorothy's neighbor saw Greg's work in one of these mailings.
And this fellow was also an artist, and he said, oh, wow, this is great stuff. There's a name for this and a big market called outsider art. And I just said, well, that's just crazy. Coming late to the party, my understanding is that an outsider artist is making art for his or her own particular enjoyment and not at all for an audience. So I looked up and found an outsider art gallery in Seattle. I put together a cover letter, a packet of everything I could find that I'd saved from Gregory, and I sent it to them. And I didn't hear anything. Months and months and months and months later, they called. They had to see Greg. They had found that manila envelope behind a file cabinet and didn't know it was there until they moved. And then they opened it, this up. Finding a treasure trove of undiscovered art was very much like Christmas morning for them.
Greg had his first art show a few months later. The first drawing to be purchased went for $750. Today, a collection of his work is published in a book. His drawings are turned into fancy puzzles and note cards sold in art museum gift shops. But here's the thing. Greg doesn't care about the money. It means nothing to him. What does matter are the compliments he gets from people. And he wants to know where in the world his work is on display. Despite his success, Dorothy worries about her cousin every day. When he leaves his apartment, people don't see a famous artist. What strangers see is a large, disheveled man who sometimes bumps into people without apology, a man who has a difficult time following instructions, and who is curiously drawn to people in law enforcement.
When we go through TSA at the airport, he always makes sure he salutes everybody there, How are you doing, officer? But he cannot obey verbal instructions to put his hands over his head so they can go through the scanner. Imagine if he's out on the street and somebody says, put your hands up or put your hands behind your back or something like that. He can't do it. But on the flip side of that, people are always surprising me with their kindness.
Wherever Greg goes, the bus, the library, restaurants, his regular haunts, people know who he is and they look out for him.
He has little angels all over the city.
Greg, we gotta go. I've gotta drop this off at the front desk. Do you want me to get rid of this box for you so it's not in your way? You're not gonna use it, right?
Trash.
But you're
still- Greg is extremely happy. Most of us would look at him and say, oh, that's really a shame. You know, he's got this debilitating mental illness. He looks like a dumpster fire. It's just too bad. But you could take 10 people at random and they're all less happy than him.
And what do you take from that observation?
Well, those lessons are hard to learn. I guess it would be to not put my own values on what a life well-lived has to look like.
As we say our goodbyes, Greg turns into an airplane. This is what he does when he's happy.
Okay.
Here you go now.
I'm gonna go.
He's an airplane.
Oh, you're an airplane. Okay.
Dorothy says her cousin's success with her as a bridge to the art world, as his guardian, makes her look at other vulnerable people living on the streets, a path that could have easily been Greg's. And she wonders to herself, what incredible talents do these men and women possess that we may never have the pleasure of knowing?
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. Check 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I'm gonna have this contraption right here. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Off the Job. A quick heads up that this next piece includes some disturbing accounts of abuse that might not be appropriate for some listeners.
It's just that whenever I see a microphone, I want to make noises in it.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm Wes Browning. I work at Real Change. I've been working at Real Change since, as a volunteer or as staff, since 1994 when we started.
Wes Browning has mischievous eyes and a white beard. And if you've never picked up a copy of Real Change, it's a weekly newspaper sold on the street by vendors, usually people experiencing homelessness. Wes helps manage the vendors, writes a regular column, and frequently contributes art. But this isn't where Wes's career began. For that, we go back to the 1970s at Cornell University in New York State.
Do you want to take a crack at explaining what your research was about?
Oh, boy. There's a thing called a projective plane. The idea is two complexes are more complicated than surfaces because...
Let me explain this in simple layman's terms. You got two homotopic complexes with the same uric characteristic, provided it satisfies the Eichler condition. All right, I have no idea what this means, actually. Browning trained as a theoretical mathematician, and this is the world he ran in.
I love that it's possible to just study something, and suddenly realize, oh my God, there's some pattern here, there's something, things should fall into place a certain way, and then find out you're right. It feels a little bit like hunting. I mean, I've never hunted myself, but I've seen animals hunt. And I feel like, you know, a coyote stalking a rat. I feel like a hawk swooping down on a rabbit, because you've got something. There's something there. You see something moving, and you go to it, and you track it. And if it's something you can carry, you get it. That's all. It's the thrill of the chase, and what you're chasing is ideas in your own head, really. My father and I had not spoken in years and years and years. When I went back to Seattle, I got together with my parents and sort of buried the hatchet with him. He finally understood what I was doing to try to become a professor. He had no idea what a math degree was for. Now he understood it. And a few months after I got there, he died. I was, you know, it didn't mean anything to me at the time. I had no feelings about it. I was numb to it. And then over Christmas break, I just lost it. And I started having a panic attack. I never had a panic attack before. I was starting to have panic attacks just going to work. And then right after I did, I found that I couldn't do any more research. And it just was untenable after a while. I just couldn't take it. I had three papers written. It was going to be a while before they could be revised for publication. And I couldn't sit down and revise them because every time I try to sit down, I'd start having another panic attack. So realizing that I couldn't publish the papers, I had 50 copies made of each one, and I mailed the 50 copies off to the names of the people in the bibliography.
Browning tried another teaching gig that didn't work out. Then he came to Seattle, where he taught in a series of community colleges. But still, debilitating anxiety kept him from succeeding. And on the way, he lost his housing.
I was living in the underground parking garage at Kane Hall. I was not living there exactly. I had a car. I was living out of it. This was the second time I was homeless. Actually, I was homeless before as a graduate student at Cornell. The second time I was homeless, and this was the worst because I was mentally ill. I started seeing a therapist in 83, and it helped me to understand especially why the delayed stress syndrome would have been triggered by my father's death. My parents tried to kill me on my first birthday. My father came home, he got in a fight with my mother, dropped me headfirst on the pavement in the course of the fight, and I had a concussion that looked like it was so bad that he was going to get in trouble with his superiors in the Army. And then they had this idea that they could cover it up by propping me up against a sapling and running over me with the car, which they did. And I was in a coma for 4 months because of this. My mother was really the principal abuser. My father stopped being physically abusive because he saw the light on my fourth birthday. He thought he'd killed me again. So he stopped hitting me. He stopped being physically abusive. And he compensated for that by being verbally abusive, extremely verbally abusive, so verbally abusive that I just couldn't talk to him anymore. I never initiated conversations with him except in emergencies. And my mother, on the other hand, she never stopped physically abusing me. And the physical abuse included sexual torture. And my father was, to a large extent, even though we weren't talking, he was the closest thing to the protector that I had. You know, the protector is gone. I just did what everybody said. Everybody says, that's the past, this is the present, just don't think about it. And I did not think about it. I just tried to tell myself that that doesn't matter anymore. It's over with. And it can't get to me. And then I found out that, yeah, it can. It can get to you when you're least expecting it. And it just comes, all these feelings just come back up again. I was always missing the math. It was very painful for me, especially when I quit teaching. It was painful to separate from a career like that. Not being able to do research was painful. It was like it was over with. Like, yeah, I wanted to go back to it. I was Googling myself back in 1999, when the internet was new, and it wasn't even Google, it was Yahoo. And I was just checking, doing an internet search to find my own research, because I did do that thing. I sent out 50 copies of those papers.
Like 20 years earlier.
Yeah, and I thought maybe somebody's done something with it. I was hoping this. What my biggest fear was I'd send this out and everybody just languished in people's desks or something, and eventually end up in the trash, and I would have done all that for nothing. So I wanted to see if anybody had done something along the lines of what I did, and I wasn't really too concerned whether I got credit. But in fact, I found my name attached to my results.
Unbeknownst to Wes, in those decades since he last dipped a toe in math, his ideas had taken root. The Browning obstruction theorem. Remember all that stuff about homotopic groups and whatnot? It was now a thing.
I found it as the Browning obstruction theorem among the titles of a conference. So I looked at the person's name that was going to give the talk, and I looked him up, contacted him, and he was very excited and said he'd made his career out of my work. So I was really just thrilled to death.
Wes Browning is a writer, speaker, and artist in Seattle. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. Thanks this week to Janae Janik and Bellamy Palethorpe. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. If you haven't subscribed to our podcast yet, let me tell you what you're missing. Each Wednesday, we're now dropping an extra episode with one of our favorite stories from that week's show, followed by the backstory with the producers and me. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever else you get audio, including your smart speaker. Just say, "Play Sound Effect, the podcast." We love to hear your feedback. You can find us on Facebook or write soundeffect@knkx.org. And come on back next week when our theme is Folly of Youth. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.